The following is presented as an entertainment program emphasizing folklore. It is not intended as legal or medical advice in any way and should not be used to replace the advice of legal or medical professionals. New World Witchery is a Patreon-supported podcast. Our producing supporter this month is Conjure Cardia, a magical maker and diviner out of Michigan. Thank you so much for supporting us, and we'll be sending La Befana to drop off your magical gifts of thanks as soon as we can find her. She seems to be very busy this time of year. If you'd like to become a patron and help support the show while also getting some great perks, please visit www.patreon.com/newworldwitchery, where you can pledge $1 a month or whatever you can to help us get Broom Vroom, that Befana tracking app we've been hearing so much about. It would really help right now. And thanks to all of our listeners.
Are you looking for magic? Maybe magic that lives right where you do?
If so, join us aboard our broomsticks and ride with us from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the Yukon to the Yucatan, and find magic that's right outside your front door or just off of Route 66.
Whether you're in the Windy City or the Crescent City, the city that never sleeps, or the city of brotherly love, we've got enchantment for you.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane, and this is New World Witchery.
This time around, we're talking about seeking out our roots in folk magic with Frankie Ann Castaneda. In the book, The Dark Mother, African Origins and Godmothers, scholar Lucia Cervola Birnbaum talks about the journey of another woman, health and human rights advocate and researcher, Deborah Rose, as she sought solutions to the practical issues of health access for all peoples. Her work led her to Ghana in Africa, where she found much more than community health resources and opportunities for advocacy. The book states, her 25 years of work in holistic health have made Rose a firm believer in body memories and cellular consciousness. She states that, on an individual level, and I believe on a collective level, the body remembers the past, and the oldest memory is of darkness as the source and the beginning. The Dark Mother is the original mother. The search for roots, for identity, can be a winding path. Sometimes it carries us places we don't expect, and we find ourselves living with a history which makes us uncomfortable, excited, distraught, and encouraged all at once. We may even find we are living in paradox with two worlds or more in our minds, our bodies, and our spirits. That can lead to a lot of juggling and a lot of work. But somewhere in all of that, we also find the spaces between. What we've come to talk about on this show as the liminal. And in that place, magic. Almost always, there's magic. Our guest tonight has been doing much of that work, digging for their roots in Italian and Italian-American folk magic traditions, balancing the deep traditions with the demands of a modern world, including the outcomes of being a person with a large social media following who is trying to reconnect to traditional roots. They also balance practices like veiling or wearing head coverings with pole dancing, which can seem disparate at first glance, but which both, as they point out, are about bodily autonomy. And through it all, they seek the magic that requires work. The tactile and physical work of enchantment. We hope you enjoy our interview with the chaotic witch hunt and Italian-American folk practitioner, Frankie Ann Castaneda. Our guest this time around is Frankie Ann Castaneda, the author of Spells for Change, A Guide for Modern Witches, who also runs the popular Instagram and TikTok accounts, The Chaotic Witch Hunt. They work in the areas of sex positivity and advocacy for sex workers and LGBTQ+ embracing feminism. They've also spoken extensively and very, very fully on Italian folk traditions, of Italian-American folk traditions, and ancestral magic. So Frankie, welcome to New World Witchery.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here today.
I'm delighted to have you. Obviously, it's one of those things where I don't think anybody listening to the show is not going to be aware of who you are. It's wonderful to have you on the show. because you have definitely been on kind of a journey with folk magic.
Oh, yeah.
As you kind of first popped on the scene, so to speak.
Very strange metamorphosis, I like to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's wonderful, though. And I mean, you've really embraced it. And I see you doing the work. I see you putting in the effort for folk magic. And I really appreciate that. But I'm kind of curious, you know, if we kind of dig back into this, where does magic start for you? Like, were you interested in witchcraft as a kid? Were you interested in stage magic as a kid? Like, or was it fairy tales, fantasy? Like, where does all this kind of, where's the seed for this?
I was very imaginative as a kid. I remember really loving being outside. I remember really loving stories around like fairies and kind of almost folk tales. I mean, if you know, like the Cicely Mary Barker books of the flower fairies, that's all I read for like 2 years. And so I kind of was also raised with, my mom will like completely dispute this, but like a very animistic perspective on things. Mm-hmm. Everything is a spirit, but everything should be respected. You shouldn't take things from nature for no reason. You should care for animals and plants. Just kind of that very empathetic way of being that I think kind of influenced my folk magic movement later on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an element in that I think that like I wasn't aware of what witchcraft was or is until I was maybe like 16 or 17. But before then, I always felt very in tune with everything and nature and kind of the nature in my yard. And that's definitely where that kind of came from.
And I'm curious, you know, if you think about kind of that's sort of where you started and that sort of animistic worldview, that sort of fascination with fairy lore, fairy stories, the novels and things like that, you know, those all present slightly different versions of what it means to be magical or enchanted. So kind of where you are now, what does magic mean to you?
Oh God, that's a great question. I think there's still an element of it that I believe is focused on what I believe it was a couple of years ago, which is, you know, taking energy and working with it to make change happen. But I also think that there's an element to it that is really about community and reweaving ways of being that we don't have access to any longer. As well as that, I think there's magic is intrinsically focused on nature and spirits and animism and having relationships with those things.
Ooh, that's such a nice way to put it. The relationships where it's, I mean, that can go all over the map. Obviously, ceremonial magicians form contract relationships in some cases.
Yeah.
Folk magicians have, you know, something that's more akin to, you know, pull up a chair on the porch and sit with me a spell, you know, kind of relationships. Mm-hmm. You have particularly become very, very deeply focused on sort of the Italian and Italian-American folk practices. And I'm curious, you know, do you differentiate between Italian and Italian-American? And how did you get there? How did you come to the sort of Italian-style practices?
So I definitely do differentiate. That's something that took me some time to learn, because there's 100% a difference between Italian still living in Italy and Italian diet. Specifically, Italian-American is different than Italian-Canadian or Italian-Australian or anything along those lines. When we kind of look at those things, there's a lot of changes that have happened in recipes and in magic and in kind of different areas that have happened since we, you know, immigrated. And the biggest thing is to note is that in Italy, people would differentiate by like their regions and what region they're from. So some would be Sicilian or Calabrian, similar to us differentiating by states. And in Italian-American culture and the diasporic practices there, we're all just Italian-American. We all come from different places and we kind of all integrated and melted together. So I have a lot of teachers who are Sicilian and from Benevento and from also Calabria, like I am. But then there are people that I know that are from like North Italy that I talk to, because we all kind of merged together and shared a lot of different regional practices and things that were all in there.
I'm super jealous of having the teachers who are from Benevento, just with all the witch lore that kind of comes out of there, which is so wonderful. But that's very true. You're right. There's this sort of the thing that happens during sort of the process of migration where people, it's not that they lose their old identity, but they're fusing and forming new identities, which is very, very much, I think, what you're talking about. You know, and this is Italian American history for those who
aren't aware, you know, is it's a story of migration from many different places and reintegration here, and you're migrating and remigrating and things like that. That kind of mirrors what you've done. I know you've moved around a good bit over the past decades. And with animism being so place oriented, you know, how do you connect? How do you get in touch with that new place?
Patiently and slowly. I think are the best things that I can say that. I mean, I lived in the same place for like almost 18, longer than that, 18 years maybe. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there were some periods where we lived in other places, but like I very much knew animism by that house and the plants in the yard and everything that kind of grew around there in that temperate climate. And then I moved to Colorado and it kind of was a bit of a culture shock because I'm like, nothing fucking grows here. What is going on? Like, you got, I don't know if I can curse. I'm sorry.
You can curse. It's fine.
I'm like, there's, it's arid, it's dry. I can't get anyone to like anything to stay alive. So the first year was kind of just being present in that. I didn't really try to form any relationships. Most of my relationships during this time, I was focusing on ancestral plants. And I kind of just would go on hikes and go for walks and spend time around the plants that were around there. And then, you know, since Colorado has so many bioregions, we moved and then it was like starting over again. So I specifically kind of now, I spend a lot of time tending to certain plants in my yard, removing old dead branches. I will kind of ask for permission before I use this kind of, we use a plant in a spell. So I usually do that. If they say yes, it's kind of a beginning of a relationship. For me, a lot of animism is rooted in, you know, taking care of the land, planting native species, planting things that are going to be beneficial for the entire ecosystem and not just kind of putting whatever I want in the yard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not just deciding like honeysuckle would look really pretty here and then it's everywhere, right?
So I feel like a lot of people garden like that. Mm-hmm. And my mom never was like that. She was always like, we're going to plant native species. And our old house actually was like a certified wildlife habitat.
Oh,
yeah. So we had like monarchs and bees every year, milkweed. We had dogwood trees. There was a skunk that lived in our yard. Bunnies would like lay their nests in our yard. It was definitely a very magical place. And I think that it was a magical place because of how much like love and energy was poured into the house and the space. So for me, I know that like I'm not going to get that result within a couple of years. That's like a decade of work of tending to land and kind of making it habitable for people and habitable for ecosystems and animals. And that is kind of my goal eventually.
I love that. And I love your point about it, you know, it's the sort of slow, it's, you know, how they used to talk about kind of like this, like watching the slow videos of like somebody watching, on train knitting and things like that. But it's that sense of like, this is something that isn't going to happen overnight. At the same time, when you're moving around, you know, it can be hard to leave some of these wonderful places behind. Mm-hmm. Are there things that you take with you or like particular plants or spirits that have traveled with you through many locations?
Not really, actually. I have a couple of plants that I managed to get across country, but they're struggling in a different climate. And I think that it's difficult for plants that were grown in a temperate climate to switch to a super dry one and like thrive in that. So I think a lot of my stuff right now, a lot of the plants I have, they're very much like I found them in Colorado. Of course, I took certain spirits with me or spirit relationships with me, but I do think that the past 3 years have really been the most for me in my shift into folk magic. And that's probably because a lot of that was happening through like a major life transition.
Yeah. I mean, and it is, you know, important to like maintain those relationships, but you're right. Like when you're in these new places, you know, sinking your feet into the dirt a little bit, I think is also really important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you have any specific customs, traditions, spells, practices that you do when you're either leaving a place or moving into a new place that help you with that transition?
So, yeah, I do it some of them sporadically. When we left Pennsylvania, I did a few spells and to leave behind with the house to kind of like give the house a piece of myself and to thank it for like being my house for so long and being a threshold protector for so long. When we moved out of, then we kind of had a small house in Colorado. And then when I moved out with my partner, I didn't really do anything with the previous house because when I left, it was still like something that I could go and visit. And now I'm like, yeah, I definitely will leave something with this house that I'm in now when I go. But it kind of depends on my relationship with the actual physical structure. And it depends on how long I've been there too, and my kind of feelings of it.
I mean, it's just like with any friendship, right? Like where you treat it differently kind of depending on who the other part of that relationship is. I can see that with these spaces too.
Absolutely.
Kind of switching gears a little bit here. I know that you also have spent a lot of time, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but you identify often as a non-binary, right?
Yeah. Or gender fluid.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that kind of entails a different kind of moving and shifting, you know, people's expectations. They're, you know, people see you and automatically we're sort of trained to assign things to people. Mm-hmm. Right? We're trained to assign traits to people. But you've done a lot of really good work kind of fighting for bodily autonomy. People who don't know, you do pole dancing as part of your work. And so there's a lot of like sex positivity, queer rights and representation. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, a big part of your practices is veiling, is you know, using headscarves, which I know that many people look at that and they make the same kind of like snap judgment the other way and say, that's regressive. That's so, mm-hmm. you know, submissive or something like that. How do you balance those things? How do you tie those things in your mind?
So I will say that I am definitely, the way I approach veiling is definitely different than how people have approached them historically. Mm-hmm. Historically, it's always a practice of modesty or, you know, devotion or religious devotion. For me, it's always been about comfort and protection and kind of feeling comfortable in spaces that I'm in. I just happen to feel more comfortable with something on my head. And I do like have periods where I dress more modestly or am more comfortable wearing more clothes. It kind of depends on where I am and who I'm with. But at the same time, I also like pole dancing because I can kind of be in a space that is comfortable, mm-hmm. and be confident in that way and not really be concerned about anything. I like to shake house every once in a while. It's true. I mean, the thing about pole dancing is it is like a sport. It is like brute power. And it comes from strippers, which really ties into that kind of like, I feel as though if you are a pole dancer, you do pole fitness, you also have to be learning from strippers and supporting strippers and recognize the roots of pole. We can't really divorce that because they're still like really amazing pole dancers that I know of that are also strippers or started as strippers. And so that kind of advocacy for me, I was just like, yeah, of course I'm going to care because this is where the thing that I love comes from. So I think I'm a little off topic, but I want to talk about that too.
No, I love that.
Pole in itself, I think has recently, it's always seen similar to veiling. It's seen as something that was generated in clubs and is regressive and is made for male pleasure, right? And veiling, a lot of the times people associate it with like, oh, you're being submissive. And so there are these two things that people really associate with being not empowering at all, but I find them completely the opposite. And I think that a lot of people do. I don't know a single pole dancer that I know of that isn't like incredibly happy to be there. And I have a really great community at the studio I go to, but like we can recognize that, you know, like these things are, I don't know. It's really interesting because I'm not a sex worker. I'm not a stripper. And I feel like a sex worker or a stripper would probably answer and talk about like what pole is a little better than me. But it is really empowering because you're strong and you are confident and you're moving your body in a way that like people have told you time and time again, you probably shouldn't do that. And people disapprove of it. And I think that there's an element of that, that like to get paid for that and to do that for fun is very empowering.
Mm. I love that. And I mean, there's also this thing that I think you're doing with both of those, which is it's this reclaiming act, right? You're reclaiming pole from the male gaze. You're reclaiming veiling from sort of patriarchy. And it's almost a big, you know, middle finger to anyone who makes assumptions about it at that
point. Yeah. I think I've definitely gotten a lot of pushback, especially on being a veiled practitioner and also doing pole dancing, because people never, like, it's usually one or the other. Like, people can't stand to see someone who is being, like, the definition of a slut and someone who's being the definition of, like, a pious person in the same breath, because we're taught that they have to be separate. Someone can't be Mary Magdalene and Mary, our Mother of God. Like, you can't be both of them, but you can, because I don't really care what other people think.
Joy of bodily autonomy.
Yeah, like, I just don't. And it's so funny because people will comment and get angry at me about this. And I'm like, I just don't care. Like, I just don't have the capacity to care. I'm doing something that feels good. And sometimes that I feel good looking modest and wearing veils. And sometimes I feel good, you know, dancing on a pole. And so I think it's interesting because there's definitely, I've gotten some pushback, I think, because people assume that I am like a religious veiler. Because veiling is so often associated with religion. And I think that's a fair assumption. I think we can have a conversation about, like, making sure we don't, like, look like we're culturally appropriating a certain veiling method, especially in situations where the person who would be wearing that veiling method would be prejudiced or would receive, like, discrimination. So that's a conversation to have. And I've always been, like, mindful of kind of how I present and the veils I wear. I don't try to mimic, like, a hijab. I don't try to mimic, like, a nun outfit. And I think part of that is recognizing that those things came before I did. Those veiling practices have been, especially in Jewish veiling as well, have been longstanding. And when people are curious about veiling, they're always, I always encourage them to go to, you know, Jewish or Muslim based companies first to learn how to, like, keep the veils on, because that's who I learned from. They're like the OGs in it in a lot of ways.
Right. And I mean, they have the depth of tradition, the depth of knowledge to draw from. And I mean, it also forces you to let down your own prejudices and say, like, I'm not going to come into veiling knowing everything.
Yeah.
I need to learn from people who know more than me, which I think is a wonderful position to take.
Yeah.
Not just in veiling, but in any spiritual practice, frankly. So,
yeah.
I mean, you mentioned Mary Magdalene and Mary, Mother of God. You know, does Catholicism play a role in kind of the Italian flavor of your folk magic? Does that cross over?
Oh, yeah. It's like, I think it's, so when I first started, I was trying to keep them separate a lot. And I went to a teacher at some point that's like, you can't separate them. And I'm like, what do you mean? And I think that made me angry. I'm like, what do you mean you can't separate them? But you really, like, it's very, very difficult to separate the Italian folk magic and Italian American folk magic as we know it from Catholicism and Christianity. There are some people who have written on, like, how the younger generation in Italy is kind of changing those things. And that's Dr. Angela Pucca, who kind of talked about that. And I think that's interesting from a diasporic perspective. All of the immigrants came over when Italy was still very Catholic and the traditions were still very rooted in Catholicism. We have kind of a longstanding tradition now in Italian-American diasporic traditions of things being Catholic. But we're, none of us are like, I don't know about everyone else, but, like, I'm not a good Catholic by any means. You know, I'm like, I'm going to go to church once and it's going to be to steal holy water because I need it. And I mean, there are lots of records of people throughout kind of history and the before immigration in Italy kind of being like, I'm a good Catholic, but they do things that the Catholic Church would call heresy. So that's kind of the precedent for Italian American traditions, because that was what was carried over during immigration. And obviously things change generation by generation. I'm not going to tell someone that they have to do things like very Catholic and they have to form a relationship with Catholicism. But my friend, hold on, I'm actually thinking my friend made a post recently. Their name is Queer Catholic Mystic. And I literally saw it. I'm like, oh, that's it. Like, that's the T. And I want to pull up their thread really quick. They're an amazing practitioner. They're like a Marian devotee, I believe.
Oh, do they do the really beautiful Marian art? Is that who I'm thinking of?
They may. They made some virtual altars recently.
Okay.
Where is it? And I recommend everyone follow them because I feel like they have just been, I just love like their content. Mm-hmm. Give me 1 minute and I'm going to find this thread. Where is it? I know they posted it on Instagram, so I'm just going to go there instead. I'm trying to find this. It's like, I feel like I see posts and then they disappear. I'm like, never going to find it again. Okay. I know we're all queer and witchy here, but hear me out. I guarantee that some of your ancestors are Catholic. That means you need to reconcile your relationship to this religion to have a mutually supportive relationship with your ancestors. Mm-hmm. That's one point of view that I agree with, because I think that we can't approach ancestor work and reclamation work mm-hmm. if we're harboring feelings of discomfort around certain aspects of our ancestors, mm-hmm. because we can't, they're not like gods. We can't like look at one epithet and just work with that one epithet. They're like a whole human. Like my great grandma was really strong, really good at cooking, an amazing gardener. And she was also a devout Catholic. And I think part of this is like, even if I don't consider myself Catholic, I have to have a relationship with Catholicism or Catholic spirits that is at best, like, all right, like we're on talking terms. If I want my ancestors to kind of have their influence in my life and have mm-hmm. kind of have a supportive relationship. And that's like, this is the thing, like everyone's going to disagree here. I'm one practitioner. No one's going to agree. Some people may be like, no, you can definitely do Italian folk magic in the non-Catholic way. You can definitely do ancestor work in the non-Catholic way. And I am, you know, a folk Catholic practitioner and my family was very Catholic. So I happen to do it in the very Catholic way.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think your point about like, you're reconciling with that
yeah.
part of yourself. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're then, you know, promoting it for others or necessarily even saying like, and I approve of all of the things that have ever gone along
no.
with Catholicism.
The Catholic Church is on my shit list still. Yeah. If I was going to do a hex, it would probably be against the Catholic Church. Because the other thing is the institution mm-hmm. is not Catholicism. I genuinely think in order for people to have a good relationship with Catholicism, they have to say, okay, fuck the church. I'm going to talk to these spirits and we're going to see what happens. Because at the end of the day, they are spirits. And we can have the tried cats come into the comments and be like, you're appropriating. And I'm like, you literally converted my ancestors. You know, we can have like that conversation. But I'm like, hey, if you wanted my ancestors to be Catholic so badly, why are you so upset of my way of doing it? Because right. they want it to be done the same way it's been done for hundreds of years through the eyes of the church. And personally, I don't need a priest to like tell me how to feel better after sinning. I just go to Mary and I'm like, I'm going to pray a rosary and we're going to be good. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if I believe in the concept of sin. I'm mm-hmm. just like, it's
when
a vibe.
You need that, yeah. When you need that feeling of embracing compassion, yeah. forgiveness, however you're framing it up. Yeah. I know what you mean. And I yeah. mean, even when you look at like Catholicism, like the church is certainly a big part of its history, but yes. even everyday Catholics practicing 100, 200, 300 years ago, they were absolutely remixing. Mm. They were, I don't know if you've ever read Robert Orsi's Madonna of 115th Street, but it's a great book on Italian American immigration, but there's this whole thing about this one old woman they're celebrating the Madonna of Carmel and mm-hmm. Her way of reverencing Mary is she needs to lick the floor all the way from the door to the statue of Mary. And like the priests yeah. are like, what is this woman doing? She's like, look, yeah, I do things.
That's folk magic. She's like, yes. I've done this for 60 years. It's worked every year. And they're like, yes. Well, all right. I think the other thing too to keep in mind is that Italians, Southern Italians especially, there's a lot of history and a lot of records. I'm thinking of like Magic, a Theory from the South by Ernesto DiMartino mm-hmm. as one big example. Black Madonnas by Lucia Ciavola Birnbaum, another example.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
None of the Southern Italians like loved the church mm-hmm. because the church was taking away their traditions. The church was the thing that was making them change their ways of being. And so mm-hmm. that's why, and I actually... this is like Peter and Paul are seen as the institution. And when I was starting, I was like, I want to try to work with St. Peter. My mom's like, I don't know why, but our family didn't like St. Peter. Like, what do you mean? She's like, they kind of talk shit about him. I'm like, oh, okay. And so I found out later reading, like, I think it was either Black Madonnas or it was like Italian folk tales, where it was like Peter and Paul were the church. That's how Italians saw them. So they kind of pushed that hatred of the church onto Peter and Paul. Mm. So Peter and I have like okay relationship now, but when I started, he was like, I'm not helping you with anything. And I'm like, what do you mean? I don't know what's going on. Which is interesting because he's very syncretized in certain traditions with road opening spirits. But mm-hmm. in the Italian folk magic, he is the last saint I will go to. He is like my Hail Mary upon Hail Marys. If I am like stuck in a ditch, I've tried everything, I'm going to be like, all right, Peter, I'm sorry. I got to ask you for a favor. But he, so like this kind of not disinterest, but this kind of like strained relationship with the church punctuated all of these records of Italian folk magic, all these anthropological journals of like, because the church at the end of the day wanted money. The church wanted to change the way Italians were doing things. And like in rural peasant Italy, the church wasn't the person you'd go to if you were having trouble. You'd go to your local healer. And this kind of extends further to our relationship with the saints. The patron saint of the town would be the first one you would go to, or maybe Saint Joseph or Saint Mary. And then you would maybe try a different saint. And then like eventually you'd go to Jesus. But he wasn't the first one that he went to ever. And Italian American folklore by Malpezzi and Clemens talks a little more about that. Someone saying, you know, like, oh, I love Saint Anthony. He's my patron saint. He's more powerful than Jesus. He's so handsome. And mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, me too. I also like Saint Anthony. So that's kind of like the background for like, I started kind of practicing this way and it felt very natural to me. Like it just fit because I was like, I don't want to go to church. I'm just going to set up a Mary altar. I'm going to set up an altar to these two saints and I'm going to start praying to them and asking them for things. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to see what happens. And my first petition to St. Anthony was fulfilled. My second petition to St. Anthony was fulfilled. My 300th petition to St. Anthony is fulfilled. And now, like, I have an oil for him. I have an amazing little altar to him on my work altar. I, you know, pray the rosary in times of stress. When I'm in a tough situation, I go to St. Expedite and Mary of the Miraculous Medal. And I'm like, I don't know why this is working, but it's working, so I'm not going to stop doing it. The thing about folk magic is if something works and it feels right, especially when we're talking about ancestral things, that's kind of the way you have to go. And of course, this came kind of through my process of reconnecting with the Italian American community and culture and kind of learning more about how these saints played a role in day-to-day life, mm-hmm. the cults of the saints. And I slowly felt more comfortable because I'm like, I'm receiving confirmation. This is something this makes sense. And even though I'm not doing it exactly the way my ancestors did, how I'm doing it isn't insane. Like I'm not crazy. This is working.
Yeah. And I mean, you feel that relationship strengthening over time too. Like you said, you know, you make the offering second, third yep. time, 300th time, and you really do start to feel like you know them a little better and they know you a little better. And again, it also, like you said, it sort of connects you to them, to your ancestors. We're also petitioning them. So it's a family relationship. So,
yeah,
I love that.
Absolutely.
I mean, so other than, you know, petitions and things like that, do you have any like particular types of folk spells that you really lean on? Like, do you lean into candle magic mostly? Do you lean into, you know, doll magic or anything like that? Particularly, are there types of magic that really appeal to you?
I really enjoy making Brevi bags or charm bags. Brevi are the Italian charm bags. That Brevi means short. It was made for me. So someone would come to someone and say, I'm having this problem. They make him a Brevi. They're different than Abatini bags. Abatini bags usually were worn by someone for their entire life. And, you know, consistently they were, you know, they'd take items that were baptized with that person, put it in there. And that person would use that Abatini for the rest of their life. So I really like making Brevi bags. I've made a lot for people. I've made a lot for myself. I have like products inspired by that tradition in my shop, which are really just charm bags, but like with an Italian flair. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I really like those. And I really lean on using like oils and sprays, which is a more of a kind of a personal thing than an ancestral thing. Very folk magic-y in a way. But those are kind of the two that I utilize the most.
Love that. Yeah. And I love that you distinguish between the two types of charm bags. And I know sometimes people kind of lump it all together as one thing. But no, yeah, the sort of distinctions are important. I like that. So, okay, we also have to talk about you're well-known because you have a strong social media presence.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been in the public eye, to do this work, which does feel very traditional and sometimes can feel very private, very personal, mm-hmm. right? But you're doing so much in the public eye too. Like, is practicing folk magic kind of in that social media space, does it shape what you do? How do you sort of protect your peace in that situation?
So I think it's impossible for social media not to shape what someone does when you're as public as I am. But a lot of my actual workings and a lot of the stuff that I do, it's not shown on social media. I'll maybe share some methods, some stories, some kind of rituals. But a while ago, I stopped actually sharing the real workings that I was doing just mm-hmm. because I wasn't allowed to. There hit a point where my ancestors were like, stop telling anyone anything. I'm like, oh, all right, sounds good. And from then, I couldn't share anything about any of these projects or ideas that I had. And I think because the folk magic was so private, it's done behind closed doors, there's an element to that I honor. Some things aren't meant to be seen or shared on social media in my practice. Mm. And I'm okay with that. And I know that eventually, maybe I'll teach a class and that's how I pass that information down. But one of my teachers, Lisa Fazio, just wrote a book, Della Medicina. And that book, she's talking about how we all don't know what to do or how to pass this knowledge down, because it was originally passed orally from close relationships and really just kind of given based off the discretion of the elder and not given till the end of life. And now we have social media and all of these things are being shared. And if you look up an Italian evil eye, you're going to find three different people sharing a version of it. And I won't use any of it because I'm like, I don't like how this has been passed. So I'm a bit more traditional in that sense. I really like when traditions are shared willingly with me and orally or through a call, or I'm taught by someone who's known the tradition for a while. Mm-hmm. I don't really like pulling things from social media. And that's kind of how I then form what I post.
Mm. Yeah. So what you're posting is more of a, here's a, we're talking about St. Anthony and, you know, helping people who are lost. It's kind of a signpost in the direction, but it's not the actual door open or the road itself. Right. Yeah.
I'm people come to me and they're like, well, I want to learn more about this. I'm like, here's three different teachers that can teach you more about this. I'm not any of them. I'm not out here teaching Italian ball fest. I'm out here just sharing kind of a perspective and a personal experience of reconnection, mm-hmm. which sometimes includes some Italian folk magic, but in all is I'm just kind of here doing things, mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I think it really does. And I think that's something that I've really come to appreciate about social media. Like as much as social media can be mm-hmm. a quagmire. Bad opinions and bad takes, right? There is a piece of social media, it seems like, where people just want to share what they're experiencing and they're not trying mm-hmm. to get you to buy the thing. They're not trying to get you to, see them as the know-all teacher, but instead they're kind of sort of like what you're doing. You're saying, here's kind mm-hmm. of how I'm exploring this. I can point you in the direction of what's led me, but you have to do that work yourself. But I love that there's sort of a community building around that. And do you feel like you're seeing a positive side to folk magic being shared the way it is, or at least explored the way it is with social media?
Yes. I mean, I've met most of my teachers through social media. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have half of the community that I have now without it. But in turn, I think that we all, I personally am my relationship with social media is strained at best. And right. I know not a lot of people my age feel that way. A lot of people do. But all the people my age that kind of feel this way are the people who have a huge public eye on them, because we're all burnt out and all right, I'm tired of this. Let me go mm-hmm. home. I know a lot of people who still really love social media and love what it does. And I love it to an extent, but I also think that I need to have really strong boundaries with it, or else it ends up eating away at me. I always said when I was on TikTok, I always said that social medias were like egregores. Algorithms were like egregores, these giant spirits that have been fed so many times. so I just, and like part of my animism is like, I think of these platforms as spirits. And I think that they're not entirely benefic. They're a little malefic a lot of times. They don't really care about people or humans. They care about what is going to get them fed, right? Mm-hmm. So think of like a viral video feeding them the most. And I think that TikTok was like the worst spirit I had ever come across because it just did not care. It would push random things. It loved controversy. It loved short videos. It loved really horrific things that aren't beneficial to community and really caring about other people. And I think in order to interact with these social media spaces, these egregores, these spirits, however you want to say it, in a way that is helpful to everyone, you have to be intentional with it. And you have to have strong boundaries. And you also have to be like, all right, taking a break. You can start for a little bit and mm-hmm. then kind of go from there.
Yeah, I love that point. I love the phrasing of you can starve for a little bit. Sometimes you need to make the social media go hungry. And I appreciate mm-hmm. that a lot. If you kind of, you know, imagine the future of folk magic, obviously we're in an age where information is flying back and forth everywhere. And you've kind of reached a point where you've been able to kind of slow down and start doing folk magic at that slower level. Is that, do you feel like that's kind of where the pendulum's going to swing again, that we move back into that slow space? Or do you feel like,
God, I hope so. I think that no one benefits from living a fast life. Mm. I think it, at the end of the day, and here's the thing about folk magic and my folk magic and like what I was taught is that to kind of reweave that connection and reweave folk magic, you need to reweave community, and community doesn't happen quickly. It happens over years and years and trust. And I think that like living slowly is revolutionary. It's a privilege in a lot of ways, but it's also revolutionary. I'm like a queer disabled practitioner, and I'm like, you know what, fuck it, I'm not doing anything today. And that in a way is a little revolution because capitalism wants me to be so concerned about like money and buying things that I can't focus on anything else. Mm-hmm. But I think an element of from plants from this journey is realizing that like, no, sometimes you just got to stop moving for like a couple days, maybe a week, mm-hmm. and have people be like honest with people when you need them to show up a little more. Mm-hmm. Be like, hey, I'm in a shit place. Can I get some extra support? And half of the time they will do that. I think that a lot of people are really scared to ask for help. But to be in community and to be with people, there is a element to this that like you have to be okay with asking for help.
I mean, community is interdependent. And it's, I love your plant metaphor there, because part of it is, you know, slow down, take root. Part of it's also learn interdependence. You need your pollinators. You need mm-hmm. your sunshine. You need your rain, right? Like you are interdependent on the things around you. I love that.
Absolutely.
Well, Frankie, it's been wonderful talking to you. Before we kind of turn you loose to the world again, are there any projects you're working on, any things that are coming up that you want to share with folks, places they can find you, things that you're going to be doing?
I think this will come out. I mean, I don't know when this is going to debut, but I do have a project for my shop that's coming out. That's going to be a bunch of veils embroidered with like sigils that are for specific intentions. And those are probably going to release around the time this comes out. So if you're interested, you can like head over to my website and grab something. Apart from that, I have another book coming out next year. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm allowed to like debut it, but I'm doing it anyway because I'm so tired of my editors.
Do it.
But it's called Ancestral Magic, and it's about like a guide to reconnection and reconnecting with ancestors and also guiding you to reconnect with folk magic and culture. And that's going to come out probably August 2025, I hope. We've had a lot of delays. We've had a lot of mishaps with it. Mm-hmm. So I am just kind of happy to be like, this is the book and it's coming. I don't even have a pre-order link yet. Like that's how far away it is. Mm-hmm. But I worked on it for like 2 years. So, and it's still being worked on. So technically 3 years. So it's like really kind of what I think I'm passionate about. And eventually you guys will get it. I don't know when. If you want some, you know, extra things, I have an ancestral magic workshop that you can buy that's kind of based off the book. Mm-hmm. And that's on my website as well.
Excellent. We're going to put links to all of that in the show notes, let people find your link tree, all that kind of stuff, so they'll be able to keep up with this. I love that you, thanks for premiering it on the show. That's fantastic.
I know. I was like, they were like, my editor was like, when do you want to premiere this? I'm like, I don't fucking know. I kind of want to do it now, but I'll do the official premiere in November.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I've been like teasing it. Like, people know that I've been working on a second book for like 2 years, and they're like, what the fuck is going on? And I'm like, I don't even know. Am I allowed to say anything? I don't care anymore. Like, that's the book. I don't have anything else to give you. That's just the name. And I think honestly, starting sooner rather than later is better.
Sure. Yeah.
So this is its debut. This is like what it's about.
I love that. And you know, you talk about wanting to practice slow living. You won't practice slow living until you write a book.
No, really. I'm like, I really testing my patience on all fronts. And I'm like, all right, I guess it wasn't time for it to come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
Son of a bitch.
That's okay. It's going to be amazing when it does come out.
I know. Now I'm like, oh, my editors are going to hate me because I'm going to want to edit more. Like, you're like, we're done. I'm like, no, we're not. Give it back. I'm going to do more because you delayed it a year. So mm-hmm. Now they have to deal with me being a menace.
I love that. Be the problem in the world that you need.
I will be the problem. I don't mind.
Love it. Oh, Frankie, thank you so much for joining us. It was delightful talking to you.
Yeah, I hope you have a great rest of your day. Thank you so much for having me.
The process of digging through our past, seeking out our roots, and trying to make sense of it all can be extremely daunting. Even more so, the modern age can feel like it loads us up with obligations to perform our magic in a way that is picture perfect. To be authentically traditional and aesthetically pleasing at the same time, and always get it right from the get-go. But magic, frankly, is messy. It can lead us in strange directions. It can make us live with paradoxes. We can find ourselves working with traditional herbs, knitting brevi bags, and wrapping our heads in scarves as part of our devotional work. And then sometimes we can shake our asses in short shorts and high heels, celebrate our queerness, and demand the opportunity to control our own bodies too. And all of it is valid. All of it, in the end, can be magic if we make it magic. Our immense thanks to Frankie and Castanea for joining us for this conversation. We hope that you'll check out their work. We'll put links to their book and their social media in our show notes, and we hope you'll consider pre-ordering their upcoming book when it's available too. If you have thoughts on this episode that you'd like to share with us, or any other episode, you can feel free to write to us at our email, compassandkey@gmail.com, or newworldwitcherypodcast@gmail.com. Both of those do reach us. You can find out about our work with Folk Magic, get access to all of our back catalog of episodes. We have over 200 articles of Folk Magic, so much more. If you just want to go visit our website, which is www.newworldwitchery.com, we have just tons and tons of resources there, so please do go check that out. And if you should feel so inclined, you can also stop by our Patreon and throw $1 a month or whatever you can afford into our hat. At patreon.com/newworldwitchery. You get some fun perks and things like that to go along with that. You get access to our Discord server. You get a newsletter every month. You get early access to some of our shows. There's some bonus episodes that come out for Patreon supporters as well. Right now we're doing a cartomancy class that I'm test piloting. And whenever I do new projects like that, I usually try to test pilot them on our Patreon folks first, so they get kind of first dibs on things like that too. So all kinds of fun perks available if you want to stop by. We certainly appreciate that. And if you can't afford to, you know, financial supporters, we totally get that. But if you want to support us in another way, you can always leave us comments on the show on places like Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Share us around, let other folks know you're listening to us. You know, word of mouth, even just letting people know, you know, what it is that you like about the show, or you know, what it is that you're listening to. That's always really helpful. So please feel free to do that as well. We'll also have some upcoming in-person stuff later on in the year that I'm going to be hopefully announcing. We'll have a lot of stuff. Actually, this is going to be a very exciting year for New World Witchery. We'll get into that probably in our first chat episode with Lane and I later on. In January, but just keep an eye out. We've got some fun and really important stuff coming up, so want to let folks know. But that'll about do it for us. Hope that you are having a good start to your 2025, and we hope that this episode maybe helped you in some way get that year going and find some magic and some joy. For now, though, we're just going to say thank you for listening and be well. New World Witchery is a production of New World Witchery Podcasts and is released under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. The title and closing music for this episode is Woman Blues by Paul F. Guernos, licensed from AudioSocket.